Hello there, and welcome into another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. First of all, some coverage relative to the election of 2016, in which Republican nominee Donald Trump won the presidency and the GOP held its majority in the Senate and House. You'll hear from J.C. Derrick of World News Group with some comments about the results. Then it's Jim Dennison of the Dennison Forum on Truth and Culture offering some insight into the way forward, especially concerning religious liberty. Plus, it's John Zmirak of The Stream with his exhortation to the new president in light of the large percentage of evangelicals who turned out to vote for him to remember their reasons why they supported him. And on this edition of The Intersection, author, singer, and conference speaker Jenny Simmons, formerly of the band Addison Road, providing some inspiration regarding the healing and wholeness God brings, perhaps not in the way we would expect. Then astronomy professor David Bradstreet, who sees evidence of God's hand in science, especially related to his field, dealing with space. Next, conversation material related to Veterans Day. It's Dan Walrath of Operation Finally Home. He's been in construction for many years. He's using his skills for God's glory to help veterans and their families by providing houses for them. Finally, in partnership with Open Doors USA, I had the chance to talk to a Central Asian pastor using the name Aleem, who discussed his work and some of the challenges he's encountered. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Election 2016 is now in the books, and the implications are continuing to develop. You'll hear from three different guests, the first of which is J.C. Derrick, Washington Bureau Chief of World Magazine and World News Group, who shared with me some of his observations regarding the results.
There's a variety of things. There's certainly his economic message, which at times on things like trade certainly would go against the traditional Republican orthodoxy, but it clearly resonated. The big hit for him was in the Rust Belt. A lot of white, blue-collar, white working-class voters who just said they've had enough. But I think you also have to take a look at the social element, because the lengths to which the Obama administration has pushed the envelope on social change, whether it's allowing women in combat or transgender bathroom rules issued to schools around the country, or same-sex marriage. There are so many issues that really seem to take the country as a whole to a place or many Americans just weren't comfortable with. And that goes beyond just the social conservatives and the evangelicals. It goes to people like a guy I talked to in Pennsylvania a few weeks ago who said he voted Democratic every election in his life, including Obama twice. And he was all in for Donald Trump. And, he said it felt like to him, he goes, it just feels like they just are taking us way too far in a liberal direction. And so, I think that was really a key element that sort of flowed through a lot of these other issues and things that people may have voted on. It was just like, in a sense, it was like Red America Strikes Back. And they didn't always line up. They may not always think that Donald Trump was going to do exactly what he said. I heard a really good statement that said, the mainstream media and the elites didn't take, they took Donald Trump literally everything he said, but didn't take him seriously. Whereas nearly 60 million people seemingly took him seriously, but not literally. And many of the things he said, whether it's, outrageous statements he said, a lot of people were just willing to dismiss those things because they believed in the core message, which was, really a sort of a nationalist, populist message that we're going to be America first. We're going to make America great again. And I think many people, whether they believe that he will fully do that or not, they do believe that he is going to take us in a more conservative direction, a different direction, away from the political class and the establishment of not just the Democratic Party, but the Republicans, too. I mean, this was a wholesale rebuke to both parties. And really, he did this his own way. And not only did he win a pretty convincing electoral victory, if he won by even one vote because of the extreme upset we're talking about here, he really has an unbelievable mandate to really accomplish anything he wants almost. 81% is a staggering number, and it looks like that's what Donald Trump got in terms of evangelical support. I think it's important to recognize the nuances here, though. You know, there were not, you know, with George W. Bush, there were, you know, homeschooling families knocking doors for him and you know, Christians out, you know, phone banking for him and all sorts of things. It was really a mobilization to help get him in office, you know. We didn't see that here with Donald Trump. And we saw a few people, you know, mostly of the political class of evangelicals, you know, people, you know, Tony Perkins and Ralph Reed and James Dobson and some of these longtime moral majority types who did endorse him. But really, the largest portion of evangelicals really didn't jump on the Trump train, but they ended up voting for him. And I think the lesson here is the unbelievable, unfavorable opinion that people, voters, and specifically evangelicals have of Hillary Clinton. Again, going back to the social issues and just the leftward tack of the country over the last 8 years, it has been swift, and there is real fear in the evangelical community that not only are they not just losing the culture war, but there's it's becoming an open question about whether you'll even be able to maintain your beliefs in your personal life and be able to live out those beliefs in the public square. So anecdotally, I could speak to that with my own, you know, people in my own sphere of influence who confided that, you know, they are just heartbroken over their choices. But at the end of the day, they just found, you know, Hillary Clinton so unsatisfactory that they felt compelled to vote for Donald Trump, who they openly acknowledged not liking.
J.C. Derrick here on The Intersection. The World website is worldmag.com. Next, as election coverage continues, it's Jim Dennison, founder and CEO of the Dennison Forum on Faith and Culture. He's also the author of the book, Seven Critical Issues, The State of Our Nation. In our recent conversation, which took place on Election Day, he offered some observations on the election and some of the ramifications, especially with regard to the way forward. Here now is Jim Dennison.
I think we've got three different issues in front of us. I'll start with the negative and then move toward the more positive. On the negative side, we've seen already a move. We've seen that with the Obergefell decision and the Supreme Court to legalize same-sex marriage. Now, for the first time in American history, we have a position that is, in my opinion anyway, very much counter to biblical morality that is the law of the land. And so now, once we begin executing that decision relative to religious liberty, we come into conflict here. Am I going to be forced as a minister to perform same-sex marriages since that is the law of the land? Will my church be required to ordain people that are in a same-sex relationship? Will there be some kind of discrimination that comes to bear here? Will there be 501c3 religious nonprofit status questions that will come into bear? And so on a negative side, you could see how that particular wedge issue could drive a whole host of religious liberty questions. If we're not willing to line up a settled public policy, then does our tax-exempt status come into question? Are we seen as, on some level, discriminatory? But if you take a step to the maybe toward a more positive position here, while that is a decision that was made by the Supreme Court relative to same-sex marriage, that decision has yet to work its way through the courts, so we don't really know the answer to anything I just said. The IRS certainly has not yet indicated on any level that it's willing to threaten the tax-exempt status of churches or individual ministries relative to this. There's not been the first indication that there's going to be a concerted effort to bring pressure to bear on churches relative to ordaining people that are in same-sex relationships from some legal perspective. So it's too soon to know what's going to happen on a legal level. Then if you get over to a third level and you think about this from a voting perspective, the Catholic Church is 1.6 billion people worldwide. The Catholic Church has been very, very consistent relative to biblical morality on these issues, something for which I'm very, very grateful.
What do you see as the critical components of a Christian worldview perspective now moving forward and processing the results of this election?
Now, thank you. The first thing we want to start with is the sovereignty of God. The fact that God is Lord of all that is, that there is no such thing as time with him. He sees all of this. He sees the end from the beginning. None of this surprises him. And so we're going to stand on that fact. We're going to stand on the fact that he's king and he's Lord and he is the king of the universe and we're going to be his subjects and his children. And we're going to rejoice in that fact. Then second, we're going to realize that what matters most is the eternal souls of the people that we influence. So the way in which we speak about our elected officials, especially those with whom we disagree, The way we speak about each other, the way we speak about people with whom we disagree, is critical to our witness. And the eternal souls of the people we're talking to is so much more valuable than winning a particular election or winning a debate or making some particular point. And so the way in which we go forward, the spirit of our witness, is going to be critical. The Bible absolutely makes it clear that we are to speak the truth in love, that we're to speak God's truth, but we're to do so with gentleness and respect. And so remember that the souls that you influence are far more important than any particular election, or even 4 years or 40 years or 400 years from now. And then the third point that I would make is, at the end of the day, you only serve an audience of one. Your ultimate loyalty is to Jesus himself. So ask yourself every day, just as you would have 4 years ago or 40 years ago, Lord, what would you have me do today? What's my influence that you could use in this world today? How can I be salt and light? How can you use my gifts, my abilities, my influence, my talent? How can you use me to make a difference in this culture? And recognize this, the darker the room, the more obvious the light. The Lord knew that we would be alive at this moment in time, and he called us to this moment in time, not just to where we are, but to when we are. It's by his providence that we're alive in 2016 and not 100 years ago or 100 years from now with the Lord tarries. He wanted us to be alive right now because he has a purpose and a mission, a kingdom assignment for us right now. So let's rejoice in that. Let's get about that work, and let's move forward to the glory of God.
Jim Dennison here on The Intersection. Learn more by going to the website dennisonforum.org. Election coverage continues on this edition of the Intersection Podcast with John Zmirak, senior editor of The Stream, as he shared some reflection on the 2016 presidential election, including the exhortation to President-elect Donald Trump to remember those, including evangelicals, who helped get him elected. Here now is John Zmirak.
I was a Pat Buchanan supporter in 1992, 96, and 2000. I was actually a delegate for him in 96. And I think what we saw last night was the belated victory of Pat Buchanan. Back in 92 and 96, unfortunately, evangelical Christians were a little bit more politically docile. And when their church leaders came out and told them, we have to get behind George Bush, we have to get behind Bob Dole because, you know, he's our man, they lined up and did it. Well, this year they didn't. Even though I would, you know, most of the evangelical leaders backed my favorite candidate, Ted Cruz. But you know what? Their people didn't trust him because they told them Mitt Romney would carry the day. They told them John McCain had their back and Bob Dole. And none of those people delivered. And none of those people looked out for the working class particularly either. So I think while I would prefer Pat Buchanan because I think he's got absolute personal integrity and he was a man of great eloquence and there were no recordings of him saying vulgar things about anybody. I'm very happy that Pat Buchanan supported Donald Trump, and I think Donald Trump will finally do something for those forgotten pieces of America that really were what created America: hardworking people of European descent and conservative Protestants. Now, my family are Catholic immigrants from Southern Europe. We're not part of that original coalition, but we're grateful for the America that was created by the founding fathers, excuse me, for the tolerant and generous country that was created by those cultures. And I don't like seeing those cultures treated with contempt and marginalized and forgotten by a new, arrogant, secular elite that is willing to prosecute people over Halloween costumes, but wants abortion to be legal for all 9 months of pregnancy. The moral insanity that has gripped America's elites is right up there with the elites of Europe, who are admitting millions of Muslim colonists and euthanizing babies. And remember, nationalism is less dangerous than globalism. Nationalism admits that there are limits. As I wrote in the piece, we have to acknowledge that there are limits, that there are realistic limits to everything, even America. We can only take so many newcomers every year, especially so many newcomers from very different cultures who don't have high school diplomas, most of them, who don't have very many skills, when there aren't that many jobs for teenagers entering the workforce or for less skilled Americans. And I think working class people in America saw, well, first you're outsourcing our jobs to Mexico and China. Then you're flooding the market with imports. What jobs are left for those of us who don't happen to have Ivy League degrees. You're trying to fill those up with low-skill immigrants from the third world, and then you expect us to pay welfare for their families. And it was outrageous. It was outrageous, and people rebelled.
But apparently, he does, at least from what he has said, he is desiring to serve the people that put him in the White House. Do we have the evidence going forward, based on past experience, that he'll actually be able to pull it off?
You know, that's the big question. I hope he stays true to the people who put him in office and that he doesn't pivot and decide to become respectable with the appalling Washington establishment. I don't think he will. I think he knows he owes those people nothing, and he better stick with the people who bring him to the dance.
John Zmirak here on The Intersection. The website address is thestream.org. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. You can find out more by visiting meetinghouseonline.info. There you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests here on The Intersection Podcast. Also, you can get subscribed to the podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. Also, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can get connected to video content as well. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Well, recently I had a chance to talk with the former lead singer of the band Addison Road. Her name is Jenny Simmons. In our conversation, she discussed material relative to her book, Made Well, Finding Wholeness in the Everyday Sacred Moments, dealing with the expression of God's healing and wholeness in a believer's life. This is Jenny Simmons now.
I love being with people, and after shows, I always stay out and listen to people's stories. I'll stay at the table until they kick me out of the building, talking to people. And so, you know, over the past like 15 years of being on the road, I've heard a lot of stories from people about miracles, things that have happened in their lives, like healings and being cured of certain things. But then on the flip side of that, I've also sat with so many families who have begged for a miracle, who have prayed for a cure and didn't see it happen. In fact, they saw the opposite happen. They saw the marriage, you know, fall apart, or the cancer win on this side of heaven, or the miracle not happen. And I remember sitting with those people thinking, what must it be like to believe God is powerful and that he is holy and he's capable, and to pray for a miracle and not see it come to pass? And then 2 years ago, my family walked through our own moment where we prayed for a miracle and it didn't happen. And it really rattled me and shook me very, very deeply. And so I began to just ask the Lord, okay, if this didn't happen, if this wasn't the outcome, and I still believe you're good and I still believe you're faithful, that I need you to show me what it looks like for you to be the healer in this moment in my life and in my family's life. Because right now, we didn't see the healing happen the way we thought it would. And it's like the Lord had begun to just show me that that healing happens all the time, even if a cure doesn't. And that sort of began the spiritual journey that led to this book. Is, you know, what does it look like for us to be healed, whether or not we get the cure that we're looking for?
Well, that is something very rich, and I wanted to explore that with you here for the next few minutes. When we talk about healing happens, we recognize God. That is an attribute of his nature of being a healer. He is the one that wants to heal and restore. And you talk about healing happening even when the cure doesn't come. So talk about the difference, because I would say that probably a number of us would take those two words, healing and cure, and say, well, they're synonymous with one another.
Right. Well, you know, I think the cure is the broken thing being put back together. And even when the passage about being a jar of clay and how that pottery, that image of pottery being broken, and you think about that being put back together, that's not perfectly put back the way it was before it was broken. It looks a little different. The very nature of putting something back together after it's been broken means that it's going to change its form. It's going to change its essence and its shape. And so for me, that's kind of what the healing is that it's put back together, but maybe in a different way. And so the book starts with our own journey. And my sister, she was pregnant with twin little girls, my nieces, Maggie and Ellen. And She had a bunch of complications and a very, very long story short that you can read in the book. The girls didn't make it. And they both passed away in my sister's arms. And I remember being in the hospital thinking, like, this is not how this is supposed to go. I was like in shock. I mean, it was a physical shock. And so for me, the difference is very clear. The cure did not happen. Those girls didn't live. And that's the cure that we prayed for. The healing, however, happened every single time a woman from the church showed up with a casserole and the deacons that showed up in the hospital room to pray over our family and over my nieces. And the moments I've had with God since then, when I'm hiking or I'm just in the living room and the right song comes on the radio at the right moment that ministers to my soul, it's been moment after moment like that where healing has happened. I've been restored. I've been built back and put back together, but not quite in the way that I was before the loss of the girls. And the difference has been so clearly evident. Like you and I think it's human nature. We pray for a cure. We pray for this big, great miracle. And sometimes when that doesn't happen, what we get instead is God showing up in these thousands of little tiny moments, healing us, restoring our souls, reminding us that of Psalm 23, we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but we can fear no evil, for he is with us. And healing looks like Jesus walking with us.
Jenny Simmons here on The Intersection. Find out more by visiting her website at jennysimmons.com. The Intersection podcast continues now with David Bradstreet, professor and chair of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Eastern University, which is located in the Philadelphia area. In our conversation, he discussed the compatibility of faith and science, as well as other material relative to his book, Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. Here now is David Bradstreet.
I really have no problems combining my faith with my science. God is behind all truth, and science is just a systematic way of trying to discover the truth about the natural world or the creation. And so truth can't contradict truth. And so what science comes up with, you would certainly expect the Bible to back up if we interpret the Bible, you know, correctly, or if we interpret nature correctly. And that if we're having conflicts, then one or both interpretations must be flawed. And so to me, I share the same kinds of feelings as Kepler did, as Galileo, who considered studying God's creation an actual form of worship. And I feel the same way.
Well, I understand that in the book you really incorporate some of these different, as you might say, biographical sketches. You mentioned Kepler and Galileo. Talk about some of these astronomers and how their faith really informed their work in astronomy.
They were convinced that God had set up the universe in a methodical, rational way, such that it could actually be discovered or interpreted. You know, God could have made the universe so complicated and so confusing that we wouldn't have a clue as to where to start. And so it actually almost looked this way in the beginning because they were trying, for example, to fit the orbits of the planets with circles. And that didn't work at all. And so when Kepler took the big step and said, well, maybe there are ellipses, you know, ovals, and he found that those fit the planetary orbits perfectly, that to him was a huge leap that, you know, wow, God has made a universe that's describable by mathematics. And that was really the beginning of what we call physics and using mathematical equations to describe the natural world. And this was a huge leap forward. Galileo felt the same way, that, you know, that the reading the book of nature, which is what he called creation, could only be done with geometry and mathematics. And so these guys, they were worshiping God and rejoicing in their discoveries because they felt that God gave them an intellect which allowed them to then discern his creation and give him glory. If you want to believe that the universe is a self-sustaining entity, then you can say there is no God and the universe just runs on what they call natural laws. And so I don't see God out there because I choose not to see him. my feeling is, as a Christian, I see the universe as working as perfectly as it does because it has a sustainer behind it, that he not only created this fantastic universe in all of its form, but also sustains it continually, that everything works. What people call natural laws, I call God at work. That if you take God out of the picture, nothing would exist, nothing would work. It's a very subtle but important difference. It's a difference between deism, which is believing in a God who created the universe and now is off reading a newspaper in the Bahamas, you know, letting it run on its own, and a God who's active continually in his universe. There are certain relationships in nature that if they were any different, the universe wouldn't exist or wouldn't exist the way it is. Certain fundamental constants. For example, there's a constant that describes how strong gravity actually is, that determines the strength of gravity, the attractive pull of all matter with all other matter. If it was any stronger than it is, stars would burn their fuel too quickly because the gravity would be pulling them very tightly and it would cause the nuclear fusion to go even faster, so they wouldn't last very long. If the gravity was weaker, stars wouldn't form in the first place. The very form of the gravitational relationship, it's an inverse square law. That's the only kind of law you can have and have stable orbits. The same is true with the electrostatic law, which is what keeps electrons orbiting protons. That also is what's called an inverse square law. And again, if it's not inverse square, you cannot have stable orbits. And so both gravity and electricity obey this kind of a law, which is, it's as if somebody was saying, I've got to have stable orbits. And so this is the relationship that there has to be.
David Bradstreet here on The Intersection. You can learn more through the website euastronomy.com. Well, this podcast is being released on the weekend following Veterans Day. Prior to Veterans Day, I had a chance to chat with Dan Walrath, founder of Operation Finally Home, providing mortgage-free homes to veterans and their families. In our conversation, he shared about the call of God on his life to help veterans and discussed the book Building Hope, What Happens When God Changes Our Plans to Accomplish His Own. Here's Dan Walrath now.
What took place was actually back in 2005. I was approached by about remodeling the home of a family whose son had been injured by an IED, a roadside bomb, in Iraq. The young man had sustained some severe head injuries, and a friend of mine reached out to me to go talk to the family, and I couldn't figure out why, because I was not a remodeler, I was a custom home builder. And so I felt like I needed to go talk to the family and recommend a remodeler to the family. And got over there, and the mother was still at Bethesda with the young Marine and Stephen, and dad was there at home trying to get things ready to bring his son home, which was going to be in a wheelchair. And they had the option, they could put him in a home or bring him home. Of course, they didn't feel like they had an option. They were going to bring their son home. Home did not accommodate any of the problems that the house faced for young Stephen. So anyway, after he showed me a picture of Stephen before and after his injuries, just broke my heart. And so I told him, yes, let's get this thing done. And basically I told him, just, you know, keep their money because of their sacrifice and service to our country, that I felt like we had an obligation to help the family. So we did. And it turned out to be such a blessing to be able to help the family. And come to find out, when I just reached out to all my resources, everybody gave. Nobody said no. And so we did about $100,000 remodel. Didn't cost anybody a dime. And it was a great blessing to the family.
Mm. And, of course, this took off. Your book, which is called Building Hope, actually details how Operation Finally Home really grew, how God blessed it. Talk about how you saw God's hand in really expanding what you did through Operation Finally Home.
You know, God blesses everybody with a talent. And my talent was being a home builder. And I just never could figure out how we were going to be able to make a difference in building homes and helping these families. Being a small builder in Houston, Texas, that one home at a time just couldn't have that big of an effect. But, you know, God had put a passion in my heart that I really wanted to do something. And I'd never had anything like this in my life. My wife and I've been married 46 years now, but, back then, you know, our life consisted of church, our sons, our grandkids, and my business. And so, you know, couldn't figure out why, you know, if he was putting such a passion in my heart about helping these families, because over the years of serving in church, you know, I've been prompted to do things like most folks, but this was different. And, so I just said yes to the first project. And after we got done, then, you know, I said yes to the second one and yes to the third one. And, you know, I think if God had revealed what he had in mind, for Operation Finally Home, it probably scared me to death. I'd probably run off. But, you know, today we have some 98 homes in different phases of construction in 33 states. So, you know, we serve a big God, and he can make those things happen.
Dan, tell me about what you would desire to communicate through this book, Building Hope.
The reason I didn't sit out to write a book. It was just it was one of those things that God just touched my heart. He, you know, that just write the stories about what has happened, how big a God we serve, and all the miracles that he's performed. And so I just started logging the stories, and then one thing happened, and then all of a sudden it turned into a book. But what I'd like for folks to know is that, you know, when God has given each and every one of us a talent, and we have the responsibility to use that talent for his glory. And, you know, just, you know, when God prompts you or puts something on your heart, just say yes. Just say yes. And God will qualify. He will qualify the unqualified. That's what he did in my case. And I'm very unqualified. But that's what he does, you know. And it's just been amazing, amazing journey. But that's what I want folks to know, is just don't be afraid to say yes. And God can do great things through you.
Dan Walrath here on The Intersection. Learn more through the website OperationFinallyHome.org. Finally, on this edition of The Intersection podcast, it's a Central Asian pastor using the name Aleem who is scheduled for an interview with me in association with Open Doors USA in advance of the November 6th International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. In our overall conversation, he discussed some of the unique challenges in his region and talked about Muslims coming to Christ. From that discussion, here now is Aleem.
First of all, I'm pastor in the church that was established by missionaries back in the 90s, by American missionaries that came into the region. And today the church is handled to the local pastors, local leadership. So with this is part of my calling to lead the church. And I also involved in serving persecuted church in the region. That means I'm traveling and supporting, inspiring, helping, supporting the church, persecuted church in Central Asia.
Tell me a bit about some of the challenges that the church is facing in that part of the world.
Yes, well, with new regulations and a new kind of page of Christianity in our part of the world, we are limited from many sides. For instance, the government would not allow us to proclaim and publicly share about our faith. That means we are prohibited sharing our faith on the streets. We are prohibited to share pamphlets or brochures about our activity. So we kind of keep our faith sort of secretly, without making it publicly known. This is one of the biggest kind of challenge that we face today. But in many regions, there are different type of in different regions of Central Asia, there are different type of challenges that the church, persecuted church, faced with.
And if someone were found to be in violation of these regulations, what sort of punishment are they up against?
You could be fined. You could be the administrative type of case could be started against you, but it could turn into the criminal case, and of course you could be imprisoned for or detained for this type of activities.
So, as far as a church operating, are you allowed to have a church building, or are you primarily underground, or how does that work as far as the governmental regulations?
That's a great question. Yes, my church is officially registered with the state. We have official recognition by the state. Thus, this allowed us having our own facility. We actually built our facility back in '90s when it was kind of open for event for the gospel, for evangelism in country. Well, right now many churches facing challenges of not allowing to have their own facilities. For instance, with the new religious law, many churches couldn't face the requirements, couldn't meet requirements that the new law kind of required, and thus many churches went underground. So I see so many churches in country that went underground and became secret churches because they couldn't meet the requirements of the new regulations.
I understand you have some knowledge about the spread of Christianity among Muslim people. Tell me about that, if you would.
Yes. I do believe that the future of the church in our region is MBB's church or Muslim background believers church, that is actually going to be like the face of the church in our region. Why saying this? I see that lots of Muslims who are becoming to Christ, comes to know Christ, they are going through persecution. They already know what is suffering, and isn't it Jesus said to the church, "You will suffer as I suffered." That's what Jesus left to us. I mean, he already prepared us by saying, "Love your enemies." That means we have to love those who are persecute the church. And with my understanding that the gospel is spreading around Muslims and in future, I see it already right now that the face of the church is the MBB's church in my region.
A Central Asian pastor using the name Aleem here on the Intersection Podcast. Learn more about the persecuted church by going to the website opendoorsusa.org. Well, we are nearing the end of this week's edition of the Intersection Podcast, the weekly production of The Meeting House. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Through that site, you can get connected to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand. Also, you can subscribe to the Intersection Podcast. Plus, there are two blogs accessible. One is The Three, with three stories of relevance to the Christian community. The other is The Front Room, featuring devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House program. And you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. Video content is accessible also. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Intersection Podcast. I'm Bob Crittenden.